Hey, Levitt.
Hey, Dubner.
When I say the word tipping, what do you think of?
I think of discomfort.
Discomfort for whom?
Oh, for the tipper. For me, I don't like to tip. Tipping's unpleasant.
Now, it's not that you're an ungenerous person. I find you quite generous.
Yeah, no, I just don't like social interactions that much. And I don't like the idea that I'm not sure how much to tip or what's fair or what's right. Can I say something about you?
Sure, Levitt, go ahead.
So I always thought I was a good tipper until I hung out with Dubner. I mean, man, you throw the money around like it's going out of style. It's embarrassing
true.
To be
That's
around you. It's so embarrassing. Oh, man, we get in some car, some sedan to take us 15 minutes from one place to the next, and you're flashing 20s and 50s and stuff like that.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author, thinks I am a grotesque tipper. For the record, I believe he's exaggerating. But yes, I do routinely tip people who work hard for a living, especially when they're not getting paid all that well. That said, I agree with Levitt that tipping can lead to discomfort, can be confusing. Why do you tip a hotel doorman, but not the person behind the reception desk? Why do you tip a baggage handler at the airport, but not the flight attendant? How much is enough for a tip? How much is too much? And if you're on the receiving end, how do you get the biggest tips? This is a question that everybody has an opinion about. We talk to people all over the country who work for tips.
My name is Tanya. I'm a server, and I'm in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I'm Johnny Glowey, and I'm a valet.
Krista Olison. I've been bartending for over a decade.
I'm a barista.
Coffee barista.
I am a server.
I'm a server at Denny's.
I'm a hairstylist.
A barber at Jaime's Haberdashery.
I've worked many jobs for tips, as a barista, as a bartender, and as a doorman.
My name is Iris Green, and I'm a stripper.
You know what's really interesting is if you see somebody smoking, they're usually going to be a good tipper.
The older, the fatter, the better.
You can get a guy that looks like a bum, it turns out to be a super guy, and you get a guy that looks like a millionaire, and he won't tip you a thing, you know.
Black card holders from the American Express, 10 to 15%. I understand you got rich by being frugal, but that doesn't fly. And look at their shoes.
The shoes?
The shoes. Shoes can say a lot.
Tipping is an idea that economists, traditionally, have a hard time with. Why should I give more of my money to someone else on top of what I've already paid for a meal or a ride to the airport? And what is a tip exactly? A fee? A tax? Is it altruism? We needed to find someone who could answer all of our tipping questions.
My name is Mike Lynn. I'm a professor at the Cornell Hotel School. I do research mostly on tipping behavior.
There you go. Why does Michael Lynn find tipping so interesting? In his words, it's, quote, not only because it is widespread, but also because it is an expense that consumers are free to avoid. And how big is this expense?
I haven't done it recently with the most up-to-date records, but approximately $40 billion a year is tipped in the United States.
$40 billion a year.
Yes.
Holy cow. I'm clicking around here. I see that the budget for NASA is under $20 billion, so we could build two NASAs for tipping. So that's a pretty astonishingly large amount of money for what is essentially a voluntary financial transaction, yes?
I think so, yeah.
Lynn has written more than 50 papers on tipping behavior. Here's one title. Are Christian/religious people poor tippers? The answer to that is yes, relatively speaking. Here's another paper, Sweetening the Till, the Use of Candy to Increase Restaurant Tipping. Yes, Michael Lynn found that candy correlates with higher tips. As you can probably sense by now, Michael Lynn has studied all sorts of factors that may or may not influence tipping. If we could, we could almost do this as a sort of a lightning round if you're comfortable giving short answers. Talk to me about how tipping varies based on the following factors. Let's start with attractiveness of the server.
Attractive waitresses get better tips than less attractive waitresses. Men's appearance, not so important.
Okay. And what about a waitress versus a waiter generally?
Hard to say. In general, I would say waiters get better tips from women than men. Waitresses get better tips from men than women.
And what about, let's say, among women, hair color? Blonde is better than brunette or red, or no?
Yes. Blondes get better tips than brunettes. Slender women get better tips than heavier women. Large-breasted women get better tips than smaller-breasted women. Surprisingly, at least in the studies I've done, women in their 30s get better tips than either younger or older women.
So a skinny, good-looking, big-breasted woman in her 30s is going to get big tips.
I would simply replace the word skinny with slender.
Slender. A slender, good-looking, big-breasted woman in her 30s gets big tips. Color me shocked, I have to say.
Yes.
I have tried using my feminine wiles before and with mixed results. When I really made an effort at that, it tended to work.
You know, you just flash your smile and you make sure your hair and your makeup is done, even if you're sweating like a pig. As long as your hair and makeup's done, you'll be all right.
I pretended to be French for a while, and I put on this accent like this, and I said I was from France, and I have been in New York for, I don't know, 6 months, and I love it, but it got so tiring, though. I was exhausted. It worked, though.
So how does Michael Lynn know what he knows? Well, he's studied tipping since he was a grad student.
The first study I did on tipping was outside of an IHOP.
Then, as now, he looks for as much data as he can get. Even today, he'll still stand outside a restaurant, interviewing customers as they leave.
Asking them questions about their perceptions of the dining experience, how much their bill was, how much they tipped. Some of it is having servers keep records of their customers, including their bill size, tip amount, and race. But a lot of it is either online or telephone interviews with customers asking about their general habit, you know, tipping habits and tendencies.
He focuses on restaurant servers, since they take in about 70% of all tips in the U.S. The server-customer relationship begins the minute you sit down.
Introduce yourself by name, not in some remote, mechanical kind of way that says, hi, I'm Mike, I'll be your server. But if you can genuinely have a conversation with that table and as a part of that, you know, introduce yourself by name, that's good.
Well, let's hear you introduce yourself the right way, because the way you just said it is the way I hear it a lot. And I have to say, it doesn't make me want to cozy up and dump a 20 in his pocket.
That's true. Please understand, I'm I'm no longer a waiter. The reason I didn't get good tips when I was a waiter is I'm not the most sociable of people, so I'm not sure I can do it right.
I'm sure you – come on.
But I think that, you know, if you go up to a table and go, hi, my name's Mike, I'm going to be – no, see, it's starting to sound mechanical. I don't know how you do it, especially if you're having to do it over and over again without being mechanical.
Right. So that's interesting. Even the tipping sage cannot master the game. This is a complicated art, no? What else, what are the other habits or traits or tricks that a server can do generally to increase? You said a little bit of a touch is good. I'm guessing a lot of a touch is not so good.
Although I did do one study where I had a server touch customers and either count 1-1,000, 2-1,000, remove his hand, or touch and count 1-1,000, 2-1000, 3-1000, 4-1000, and then remove his hand. Obviously, the counting was meant to be silent.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The point is that 4 seconds actually seems like a long time. And it turns out that he got higher tips in both conditions. It didn't matter how long as he touched.
As long as there's a touch, yeah.
As long
and
as
where was he touching them?
On the shoulder when he went to deliver the check at the end of the meal.
I mean, particularly, it depends on the job. But at this job, yeah, I definitely touch people on the like on the shoulder. Often when there's a big party and I need to like lean in, I'll just tap them on the shoulder and be like, hey. My boyfriend, who was also a server, we worked together for many years at the same place. He would bend down, you know. But I always thought that was a weird thing to do as a girl. I don't know.
I've never been one of those people that does, you know, that like tried leaning down and talking to people or touching people. I just could never quite get into that rhythm.
If I'm gauging a client and he's much older and he wants to sort of make sure that you're okay and you're going in the right direction in your life and he's taking kind of a fatherly approach to you, at the end of a dance or at the end of a champagne room, you know, you might touch his shoulder and say, thank you, sweetie, and ask him if he wants to take care of you. And always flash a really big smile, because if you don't, you're not getting anything.
What about, you know, sometimes a server will write the little note, you know, thanks or a smiley face or whatnot. Is that,
sure.
Does that work?
Yes. Smiley faces have been shown to increase tips of waitresses, not of waiters. Drawing other pictures, like of a sun, increases tips. Squatting down next to the table or pulling up a chair and sitting at the table if there's room will increase tips.
And when they increase, by how much are we talking?
In one study, the server got $1 more per table when he squatted down next to it. And it turns out this was one of my former students. I asked him, what do you do to get better tips? He goes, oh, well, I squat down. And I said, you really think that helps? His response was, sure, I know it does. And I asked him if he'd be willing to test his theory. He said, sure. So he agreed to randomly assign his tables to conditions. He would squat or not squat. And sure enough, he was right. With those tables he did not squat at, he got $1 less. So it cost him money to help me do this research. But I put him as an author on the paper. There's a small compensation.
So clearly, there are all sorts of little things that can nudge a tip up or down, but forget all those little things for a minute. What about the big issue? How good is the service? The conventional wisdom says that good service brings a good tip and vice versa. True? Not true, says Michael Lynn.
First off, I've done a lot of research looking at the size of tip and how it relates to the customer's perceptions of service quality. And a consistent finding is that there is a relationship. People do tip more the better the service they get, but that relationship is very weak. It's a correlation. The average correlation is 0.2. That means about 4% of the variability of the differences in the percentage tips left by different dining parties can be explained by their service ratings. So up front...
It's astonishingly low, isn't it? Not just a little bit?
Yes, it's astonishingly low. So it's absolutely the case that tips are not as strongly related to service as you would expect. Absolutely, I believe that that's got to reduce the incentive value of tipping. Having said that, though, even though the actual relationship between tips and service is low, servers think there's a relationship, and that's enough to motivate them to deliver good service.
What can you tell us about race of the tipper? So there's, you know, waiters talk about that certain racial and ethnic groups, and I should say national groups, always tip, you know, worse than others. What do you know about that?
Blacks tip less than whites in this country. They're more likely to leave without tipping at all. If they do leave a tip, it's on average a smaller amount. They're more likely to be flat tippers and not tip a percentage of the bill. it's partially a little bit mediated by socioeconomic status. That is, blacks also have lower educations and incomes in this country than whites, and people with higher incomes and educations tend to tip more. So that's part of the reason that blacks tip less, but it's only a tiny part.
What's the other part? What do you know about why that is then?
I can tell you it's not exclusively an issue of service discrimination, because I find even controlling for the customer's perceptions of service quality, blacks tip less than whites. The most powerful explanation is that it is a difference in perceived injunctive and descriptive tipping norms.
Ooh, I didn't understand that.
All right. An injunctive norm is a norm about what you should do.
Okay.
And a descriptive norm is a norm that describes what people do do.
I see. Uh-huh.
Okay. What I found is that blacks in this country, only about a third of them, if you ask, how much are you expected to tip in a restaurant context, only about a third of blacks will say, give an answer in the 15 to 20% range.
I see. And that compares how to whites? And
two-thirds of whites.
Interesting. It makes sense that social norms vary from group to group, right? So
yes.
I guess it's not so surprising in some way.
That's right. It's not completely surprising. But what's surprising to me is knowledge of the injunctive norm explains only about a third of the black-white difference in tipping. When I include differences in descriptive norms, because I could know, oh, yeah, you're supposed to tip 15%, but nobody really does that, right?
Yeah,
that
yeah,
would be
yeah.
being aware of the injunctive norm but having a different perception of what the descriptive norm is. And it turns out that there's also a black-white difference in perceptions of what people do. If I take both of those perceptions of the injunctive and descriptive norms, I can account for about half of the black-white difference in tipping.
Hmm. Hmm. Wow.
What's beyond that? I'm stumped. I mean, I have tested everything I can think of. If any of the listeners have ideas, have them email me, because I'm looking for areas to do, you know, to test next.
All right. That's fascinating. So first of all, what is your email?
wml3@cornell.edu.
They call me Jack Rabbit. Call me Jack Rabbit. I am an exotic dancer.
My name is Yvette Morgan, and actually I'm a host at a restaurant.
Basically because, I mean, not speaking for all blacks, but we have a mindset of the fact that whatever we're doing for that service, we're getting paid. So a tip is basically a gratuity, which is an extra. And then, I guess in other cultures, they see it as a form of income. I know, for example, when I talk to some people that I know that are white, you know, when it comes to restaurant tipping, they always presume the fact that, well, they don't make any money, so the tip is all they count on. So they view it differently.
It's your attitude. It's your attitude. I mean, I'm not saying that black people have bad attitudes, but if you don't, you know, you can make good tips if you have a good attitude. I don't care if you're black or white or whatever. If you have a bad attitude, you're not going to make good tips.
What about differences in tipping for black customers toward black versus white servers?
Both groups, blacks and whites, will tip a white server more than a black server. And that's even controlling for perceptions of service quality.
So a black customer will tip a black server less than a black customer will tip a white server.
Yes.
All else being equal.
Yes.
Wow. So it's fascinating. What can you tell us about other racial or ethnic groups, Asians, Latinos, immigrants versus, you know, on and on? I'll
sure.
take whatever you have. It's fascinating.
The data on other ethnic groups is more mixed. There are several studies finding that Hispanics tip less than whites, but there are studies showing no Hispanic-white difference in tipping. I haven't yet teased apart what's going on. Why am I getting it sometimes and not others? And the same thing is true with Asians. I do have some studies showing that Asians tip less than whites, other studies showing that they do not. The one thing I can say for certain is that the Asian-white difference, even when it does exist, is very fragile. That is, I can control for things like sex, education, income, and it disappears. The Hispanic-white, when it exists, is often robust. I can control for education, income, and it's still there. but I don't find it as consistently as I find the black-white difference.
With all groups, once you control for income, if you can, men versus women as customers, who tips more?
In general, there's no sex difference.
Is that right?
Yeah. And even the sex of server, sex of customer interaction that we talked about previously, it has been observed consistently enough for me to say it's a real effect, but it's not universal. You don't always find that effect either.
I see. What about the age of the customer?
Older customers tend to tip less. They're also more willing – they base their tips on service quality a little bit more than younger people.
Mm-hmm. So let me you obviously know so much about this strange but common practice of tipping. If you could rewrite the custom, rewrite the social moray, which is obviously impossible because it arrives over a lot of time with a lot of people participating in it, what would you do? How would you make tipping more either sensible or directly related to the things it should be related to and so on?
You know, I think I would outlaw it.
You would.
Yeah. And it might be illegal as it is because of the race of server effect that we had previously discussed. It's you can make the argument that tipping is a condition of employment that has an adverse impact on a protected class.
So it's discriminatory.
It's discriminatory.
Saying.
And the Supreme Court has ruled that even neutral business practices that are not intended to discriminate, if they have the effect of adversely impacting a protected class, are illegal. And so it's not inconceivable to me that there will be a class action lawsuit on the part of ethnic minority waiters and waitresses claiming discrimination in terms of employment.
Now, if you live or travel outside the United States, this entire discussion on leaving a tip in a restaurant might seem ridiculous. Much of the world operates on the simple premise of a service charge or a fixed price, no tip expected. The U.S. is empirically tip crazy.
In the U.S., we have 31 different service professions being tipped.
That's Magnus Torfesson.
In Canada, we have 26 or 27, which is the same as in India. In the Netherlands, we have 15. Then we have in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, we have between 5 and 10. In Japan, we have 4. And in Iceland, we have 0.
Torfesson is an Icelandic business professor.
So that's on the exact opposite end of the spectrum from the U.S., which is the country where tipping is most prevalent.
Now, why was he comparing tipping in countries around the world? What does his research show? Well, if you're looking for yet another reason to hate tipping, listen to this.
The more tipping you see in a given country, the more corruption you generally see in that country as well.
Here's how we came to that conclusion.
So we started by collecting information about tipping in some 33 different countries and in 33 different service professions. These are waiters, hairdressers, taxi drivers, and so on. And we also looked at the levels of corruption in these countries, looking at how they scored on the Corruption Perception Index, which is publicized by Transparency International. Running a simple correlation, we found that there is a positive relationship between those two, which could have been for many different reasons. But we then controlled for a number of other factors, such as GDP, the culture in a country in general, homicide rates, and other measures of legal enforcement. And this relationship stayed significant. In other words, we found that even after controlling for these other things, we still find this positive relationship between tipping and corruption.
Why in the world would this be? Was Torfesson surprised?
Well, so I was not as surprised as many others. I started this research because I had an inkling that there was this dark side of tipping. In the U.S., we have a strong norm for tipping. And so if you're a upstanding and law-abiding citizen, you're very likely to be also a good tipper because that's what the norms tell you. And you're also likely to avoid corruption. But across countries, we see a different pattern where these norms that encourage tipping, which is a form of informal payment for services, may be leaking over into other forms of exchange, which are not as positive and not as socially beneficial as tipping.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, the big-time New York restaurateur Danny Meyer is getting rid of tipping because, well, because of economics.
I'll tell you that one of the motivating factors was really believing that we were actually co-conspirators in a system that was completely unsustainable.
And it's hard to run a restaurant when you can't find enough chefs to work for the going rate.
So we were at a definite breaking point in the industry, and that had been the same for almost a decade.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
In America, tipping is the norm in most restaurants, but that is starting to change. At The Modern, for instance, that's the restaurant on the ground floor of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, it recently got its second Michelin star under Chef Abram Bissell.
Have a great service!
Hooray!
We spent some time at The Modern not long ago with Bissell, with a server/bartender, with the general manager, and with El Jefe, the New York restaurant icon Danny Meyer. Eating, of course.
Looks pretty good.
Thank you. Looks great.
Tarte flambé with onions, bacon, carrot rillettes over rye toast, a little bit of dill, and horseradish.
And I'm going to urge you to go first for the tarte flambé
because it's better hot.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, I shall. Thank you.
Meyer is CEO of the Union Square Hospitality Group, which includes some of New York's favorite restaurants, The Modern, Gramercy Tavern, Maialino, the Blue Smoke Barbecue Joints. Union Square also traffics in private dining, sports arena catering, museum cafes. It also launched Shake Shack, which has gone international and public with a current market cap of roughly $1.2 billion. So, to say that Danny Meyer is kind of a big deal in the restaurant world, well, he is. He's a big deal. He opened his first restaurant, Union Square Cafe, in 1985. He was 27. From the outset, Meyer saw restaurants as much more than a place to just buy a meal.
You know, we are social creatures, and there's only so much socializing we can or want to do at home.
So, yes, he'd be in the food business, but primarily in the hospitality business.
It just struck me as being so odd that there was this adversarial relationship that had been created between restaurant goers and restaurateurs as if the restaurant didn't want you to be happy. And it just blows my mind that whether it starts with the reservation-making process or whether the chef is willing to make a substitution for something that, you know, you don't love on that dish. Like, I'd rather have mashed potatoes than sautéed carrots with my chicken, and the chef says, no, we don't do it that way. I just never understood that.
The New York Times described Union Square Cafe as the place where, quote, fine dining finally lost its haughty attitude. The restaurant gave customers comment cards, not something that nice restaurants typically did. And in 1990, Meyer banned smoking at Union Square Cafe more than a decade before it became law in New York.
Everyone was saying, you're crazy, you're going to put yourself out of business, no one's going to ever eat there again. And we only got busier. And I take some strength from that because I'm hearing some of those same choruses of people saying, you're crazy to eliminate tipping at The Modern and at your other restaurants because you're going to put yourself out of business.
Meyer's anti-tipping stance goes back a long time, at least to 1994, when he floated the idea in the Union Square Cafe's newsletter. The American system of tipping, he wrote, is awkward for all parties involved.
The restaurant business, we've had this economic policy that apparently dates back to the Civil War which is where people got paid $0 by the restaurant, which basically means that the waiters are working not for me, but for you as freelancers.
And so we have been conditioned after many, many years as consumers to believe that the $25 chicken entree is $25. And then when we add the tip, we truly feel like it came out of a different pocket, and we don't put that calculus into it. The American menu price structure is completely false, but we've been taught to believe that it's real.
For Meyer, the primary argument for getting rid of tipping was economic.
I'll tell you that one of the motivating factors was really believing that we were actually co-conspirators in a system that was completely unsustainable.
Okay, this requires some unpacking, some explaining about the economics of the restaurant business. You probably already know that most restaurants don't succeed. 60% fail within their first 3 years, although that's not much worse than for any independent business. There's also the relatively low profit margin in restaurants.
About 7%.
Sorry?
7%.
That's Abram Bissell, the executive chef at The Modern, one of the most beloved and best-reviewed restaurants in New York, which earns just 7 cents for every dollar it takes in.
Restaurants don't make a lot of money. The profit margin in it, I mean, from the plates to the tables to just keeping the lights on, there's a lot of expenses that I think people overlook when they think about how restaurants actually operate. But definitely our largest expense is labor, is the physical people in it.
This is where it gets interesting. There are two large categories of employees, the wait staff, who take care of the customers, and the kitchen staff, who prepare the food. They're generally called front of the house and back of the house employees. Now, ask yourself a question. Which job is harder? Well, both jobs are hard in a number of ways, but would you say that working front of the house is way, 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 way harder than working in the kitchen? Or that it requires much more qualification or experience? Probably not. And yet, that might be the conclusion you'd reach if you looked at the two groups' paychecks.
The discrepancy between the culinary team and the front of house team has grown more and more over time.
That's Simon King.
I'm the general manager at The Model.
So this growing wage discrepancy between back and front of the house.
Quite alarming statistic that in a period of time since Danny's had Union Square Cafe, and in that 30 years, the front of house salary has increased by over 300%. In that same period of time, the current team is in the mid-20s or the early 20%. I mean, that is colossal difference.
Where did this massive wage discrepancy come from? One big factor, tipping. Since tipping is based on a percentage of the bill, front of the house compensation rises when restaurant prices rise, and restaurant prices have risen, especially at high-end places like The Modern. Bissell again.
We went through a huge evolution in food over the last 10, 15 years where people demanded higher quality ingredients. It was no longer that we were trying to ask people to eat organic and locally sourced, but it started to become, I will only eat organic and locally sourced. So that, you know, that started to drive prices of menus up, right? A server has made better money over the years as the price of food has gone up. It just hasn't balanced out between the back. And I think a lot of it's, if you can't physically see what's going on in the kitchen, you don't see those people, and you don't necessarily understand the way that the restaurant works.
And Danny Meyer.
But I also think it's really important to understand that while it's wonderful that if you order a $100 bottle of wine and you're a 20% tipper, the waiter's going to make $20 as opposed for you're pulling the same cork that the guy on the next table only bought a $40 bottle of wine and his server gets $8 for that. What about the cook in the kitchen that makes the exact same dollars whether we served 300 people tonight, 200 people tonight, whether he shaved white truffles over your pasta or Parmigiano over your pasta, there's just something that's not right.
So at a place like The Modern, where the average bill is around $50 per person for lunch and $100 for dinner, you can make a lot of money waiting tables. In the kitchen? Not so much. Abram Bissell again.
Yeah, for 10 years, it had been the same pay rate.
And then give a sense of the disparity in wages between front of house and back of the house.
Well, I mean, we say there was a 300% difference between a senior level, so someone that would be actually serving the food, a server level or a captain level in our restaurant, and a senior level cook. So someone that was cooking, let's say, meat or fish, a roast.
So a senior cook might have been earning 50 grand a year, and the senior server...
Senior cook was more like about 24.
No.
So we were at a definite breaking point in the industry, and that had been the same for almost a decade.
How good do you have to be a senior cook at a restaurant like this? How much training and experience, I mean?
Yeah, I think you have to have a certain amount of natural talent, but a lot of it is experience. So I would say about 5 years of professional New York City cooking.
How do you find even one person in New York who's that good to work at a restaurant like this and pay him 24 grand, much less more than one, presumably?
It's very hard. This last summer, we were in one of the worst droughts we've been in. We were about 14 cooks short in the kitchen, which is about 50% of our staff short in the kitchen at one time. And that doesn't change how we operate. We're still a full restaurant.
Pamela Vachon is a colleague of Bissell's at The Modern.
So I am half and half a server and a bartender here.
But she didn't set out to be a front-of-the-house employee. She went to culinary school and planned to work in kitchens.
So culinary school is a 6-month certificate program. It's called the Institute of Culinary Education, but that is designed to be a short certificate program, not a degree program. Like if you go to the CIA, you get a 2-year associate's degree at minimum, and you can even pursue a bachelor's degree there.
And you can spend a lot of money doing that.
So my 6-month program was a $30,000 enterprise.
No way.
Yeah, and that is a great value culinary school, quite frankly, for the what you get.
It just makes me think that we're in not necessarily a culinary school bubble,
right,
but like all events have conspired to make that a really, really, really good business. People worry about for-profit colleges generally,
right,
but 30 grand right. for 6 months.
To enter at a field that historically pays $11 or $9 an hour right out of the gate.
Vachon's first job out of culinary school was in the kitchen at Gramercy Tavern, another Danny Meyer restaurant.
And I enjoyed that, and it was a valuable experience, but I thought, wow, I'm working, it's much, much harder work, and it is significantly less pay.
Which led her to move from back of the house to the front.
And I think you won't find a front-of-house employee in the city who doesn't think that this is an unfortunate divide between front of back and house in terms of how hard they work and how it's impossible for them to benefit from tips.
And this is the central dilemma that Danny Meyer's No Tipping Crusade is meant to address.
I'm basically just trying to shift the economics because there's unfortunately a law that states that tips, while they may be shared amongst every server in the restaurant, may not be shared with anyone who does not spend at least 80% of their time face-to-face with you.
That is a New York state law. It varies by state. In any case, in New York, the waitstaff may pool their tips, which evens things out from one front-of-the-house worker to the next. But legally, those tips can't be shared with the kitchen workers, which creates two distinct categories of restaurant employee. The ones up front, who collectively profit from the generous tipping activity of customers who've been well-trained to leave 15 or 20 or 25% of the bill. And the employees in the back, who, despite spending a lot of time and money to acquire their skills, and despite working very, very hard, make a relatively low fixed salary.
When I learned a statistic that for the first time in my entire career that we had more culinary grads working in the dining room than in the kitchen, that was the moment when I said, that has to stop, because they didn't go to cooking school to be servers.
To Danny Meyer, the big problem was, by now, obvious.
We just knew we had to go cold turkey on this whole tipping thing.
Coming up after the break, going cold turkey on tipping means upsetting the waitstaff, doesn't it?
You're wrong.
And if you want to catch up on earlier Freakonomics Radio episodes, like the one called Is It Okay for Restaurants to Racially Profile Their Employees?, you can check out our archive at Freakonomics.com or on iTunes, where you can also subscribe to this podcast. And if you can find it in your heart to do so, give us a nice rating or review. Thanks.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Danny Meyer, CEO of the Union Square Hospitality Group, decided that one of his highest profile restaurants, The Modern, would eliminate tipping in favor of a pricing model called Hospitality Included, or HI. The Modern was hardly the first or only restaurant in America to get rid of tipping, but given Meyer's high profile and the fact that he also created the fast food Nirvana Shake Shack, a non-tipping restaurant by nature, his decision got massive media coverage.
These days, some restaurants are serving up your favorite meals and saying, hold the gratuity.
Restaurant legend Danny Meyer this morning plans to take tipping off the menu.
Stop tipping.
To skip the tip.
Tipping will soon be off the table at all 13 Union Square Hospitality Group restaurants.
There were all kinds of questions. How much would the restaurant have to raise prices in order to pay its waitstaff what they were losing in tips? How much of a raise would kitchen workers get? Would servers now earn a lot less? And if so, wouldn't they all just quit? Would customers get the service they were used to if they didn't retain the leverage of the tip? There were so many questions that Union Square Hospitality held a town hall meeting open to the public. This was in November, a few weeks before the policy would take hold at The Modern. Union Square's chief restaurant officer, Sabato Sagaria, talked about the new HI menu prices.
So the true cost of dining in one of our restaurants will be represented in that price. And that price is going to vary in terms of how much it's been marked up. So some of the items, like a cup of coffee, is still going to be priced like a cup of coffee today, and others will go up at varying rates. But the main thing to know is that when you get that check at the bottom, that amount that you're reaching in your wallet, or in your pocket to pull out your wallet, is going to be about the same as it is today.
The same as it is today, meaning that the new hospitality included price should equal roughly what the customer used to pay once you added a tip. Now, how would employee wages at The Modern be affected? The lowest paying kitchen jobs, washing dishes, cleaning floors, and so on, would rise to $12 an hour, up from less than $10. Cooks would now start at $14 an hour. And what about front of the house? Here's Erin Moran, Union Square's chief cultural officer.
Our dining room team will be receiving a base hourly wage of $9 an hour, up from $5 an hour from the tipped minimum wage. And in addition to that, we will be implementing what we're calling a revenue share program, which essentially means that we will be allocating a portion of our revenues and distributing them to our dining room teams, in addition to their base compensation of $9 an hour.
Which, presumably, would make whole the waiters and waitresses while also paying the kitchen more fairly, which might help reduce some of the traditional tension between those two groups. There were other potential upsides of HI to consider. Customers wouldn't have to feel that extra money is being extracted from them at the end of the meal and even at the coat check. Simon King, general manager of The Modern, also saw HI as a way to smooth out the inevitable rough edges of waiting tables, like fighting for shifts on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights.
So for years, people have worked those nights, never had a chance to have a weekend off because they needed to work on a Saturday to make their wage. And now you can work Monday to Friday if you want to. You can work lunches and not have to work all these nights and still receive the same money or very similar to before. It's a colossal change. Some may decide the busy nights is for them. Others may say, well, you know what? Having a night with my child, tucking my child to bed is something I've never done. It may be something trivial, a lot of people take for granted. It's something, for me, very special.
When we first visited The Modern in December, the new hospitality included pricing had started just a few weeks earlier. Pamela Vachon is the front-of-house employee we heard from earlier.
So are you making more or less?
It feels like making the same. So certainly in terms of pay, obviously it's a new system. I think that there are still a few things to iron out. On the old system, your length of your shift didn't really have a factor in terms of how you or anyone else got paid out of the tip pool. Whereas in the HI system, there is a multiplier that takes into account how many hours you've worked. So the value of our shares under the revenue share system can increase or decrease depending on how well they manage the staff on the floor.
I asked Simon King what he'd seen so far. So give me the early report. Who likes it? Who's ambivalent? Who doesn't like it?
I think on the whole, we were prepared for all kinds of reactions from the public. It's such a cultural part of American way of life. It would be naive to think that it wouldn't be such a big deal, and it is a bold move. But it's a pleasant surprise for us. Was the best compliment I had from the very first couple of days from my team was that it was just like another busy day, actually, Simon. It wasn't anything different. I mean, that's probably the best comment we had. Granted, there are some few individuals that prefer the old system, some, you know, reluctant for change, but the vast majority have really embraced it.
And we talked to executive chef Abram Bissell. What are you hearing from other chefs?
Does it work?
And what do you tell them?
It absolutely does.
Danny Meyer, as the ultimate boss, who is also responsible to Union Square Hospitality Group's investors, was not ready to make any grand conclusions.
I'd say it's probably too soon to tell, but so far, so good. It's got to prove itself out business-wise.
But Meyer did promise to check back in with us later, once the hospitality-included pricing wasn't so brand new, to see if there'd been a waitstaff walkout or maybe a customer revolt over the higher menu prices. So we spoke with him again in early February.
As of today, I have one piece of good news, which is that December of 2015, where the Modern had instituted hospitality included for 5 or 6 weeks at that point, December 2015 was the most profitable December the Modern has ever had, and that was with hospitality included. And all of our leaders in all of our restaurants are actually clamoring to be next. They all want to do this because they've seen some pretty compelling statistics.
Let me just be pure devil's advocate for a minute. So if you tell me that in the first complete month after HI was instituted that you had, that was your most profitable month or your most profitable December, did you say, your most profitable month?
Both.
Both, okay. So the devil in me might say, well, that makes perfect sense because you raised your prices to make up for the lack of tipping, and it makes perfect sense that you're able to be more profitable then. And the only potential loser in that scenario is the customer who might be paying a little bit more, or the front of the house server who I would have to assume is making less. But tell me if I'm wrong.
You're wrong. Happy to tell you that. So the true cost to us of doing all the things we want to do, which is to increase the hourly compensation of our kitchen cooks by almost 20%, to keep our wait staff at least whole, and we guaranteed our wait staff that for at least the first 3 months, we would keep them whole relative to exactly what they would have made under the old system. That's very easy to do. That's just math. We know exactly what our revenues are. We knew that before we made this shift, on average at the Modern, a guest would leave 21% gratuity. So what we decided to do was to keep our waiters whole, raise our opening manager's compensation to at least $50,000, and pay our cooks $2 more an hour. And so you say, well, so how's this all working, and why is the guest not paying too much? And the only way I can explain it to you, because I never would have guessed we would already be profitable this early on, we thought this would be a long slog and that we would ultimately be more profitable by doing the right thing because we would have less turnover, we would have more applicants, a better product that more people would want to come try. The only answer I can give you as to why this happened so quickly is that the Modern, of all of our restaurants, has been the beneficiary of unprecedented public relations associated with the initiation of hospitality included.
So that is an unbelievably interesting and delicious irony, that coverage of the restaurant that was instituting, you know, big time no tipping draws enough customers to the restaurant that the no tipping policy becomes a second tier story to the fact that it just works. But I mean, now let me say this, and I say this with the utmost admiration. People are sort of talking about you as if you're Mother Teresa, or as if you've cured cancer, whereas in fact, really all you've basically done is turned an optional charge into a set charge when you eat at a restaurant. It's not that big a deal, really, is it?
I am no Mother Teresa, although in one respect I am.
That was only rhetorical.
No, but in one respect I am, because I would say that this is an example that I hope many businesses try to set, which is that doing the right thing is the most profitable thing. And I'm completely comfortable saying that we really, really hope that this turns out to have been a very smart business move. Look, I can tell you that in the very, very short time that we've been doing this, job applications in the kitchen have gone up 270% on average for the whole time. Now, we were facing an average of minus 50% for the previous 7 months. So we couldn't hire cooks. What about servers, the category of people that we were most concerned about? Because we all know that servers are only nice to you in expectation of getting a big tip. What if I were to tell you that our server applicant pool over the last 4 months at the Modern has grown 25% the first month, 100% the second month, and in the most recent month, the applicant pool has grown by 215%. And at the same time, turnover in those 3 months has already gone down in both categories.
Since hospitality included, has the average check, which now includes hospitality, gone up or down or stayed flat compared to the average old check with the tip included?
It's been just about exactly the same. And that, Stephen, that's the reason that we thought this was going to take longer to turn into a profitable structure, because the way we calculated things as we were planning this out, we really thought that the total cost of doing everything we wanted to do for staff members was north of 30%, somewhere north of 30%. But we also knew that if your credit card bill at the end of the month was basically 10 percentage points higher than it would have been if you were a 20% tipper, that you would feel that and you might just think twice about coming back to the restaurant. And we also follow the open table feedback we get. And we've noted quite happily that the average of all of the Modern experiences, both for food and for service, have gone up about, 12% since we've instituted hospitality quotient.
Danny, you acknowledge that the Modern benefited from the coverage of its move to hospitality included or no tipping. What about other restaurants that want to try this and won't get the coverage, which is to say just about all of them, maybe especially restaurants that have a less affluent clientele and lower prices? How do you think this will work for them?
Well, we're going to find that out ourselves because I want you to know we are those restaurants. We did not roll this out in all of our restaurants. We only rolled it out at the Modern. And we, just like everybody else, are waiting to see how it goes. So the next restaurant we picked, which is Maialino, does not have the same kind of check average as the Modern has, and also serves breakfast, for example, which the Modern doesn't serve. So we're going to see, how does this work in the morning time? How does it work at a very, very active, less expensive bar with snacks that are open all day? And like all the other restaurants you're asking about, Maialino is not going to get the same four-month amount of global press coverage that the Modern got. So we'll find out, but I'm really confident about it.
So let me make sure I understand this. You said that at the Modern, you guaranteed front of house staff a salary equivalent to their old salary that had tips for a 3 month period.
Yeah, let's just be careful. We call it compensation because when it's an hourly worker, it's actually legally not considered a salary, but
very good.
Compensation.
Do you suspect as of now that you will be able to continue that guarantee?
Not sure. Not sure. We're right now trying to ask ourselves, well, so which are the dates where we had to pony up extra, which are the dates where the new system actually paid them even more. And then, of course, because it's winter, you've got to correct for things like closing on the blizzard a couple Saturdays ago, which actually was a big win for people because on a day when there would have been tipping and you closed the restaurant, nobody would have come in and gotten anything. And so it's too soon to tell is really the best answer I can give you.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.